Okay, so we can continue. So before I was talking about the adaption trap, I was talking about that with some of the information cascade, and I was talking about this is the way societies often function. When you're in a societal role, you tend to adapt to this, and you tend to alienate yourself from other aspects of your personality. Now, the problem is, or what often has happened, we are confronted with completely unexpected events. That when you follow the adaption trap, or when you follow as abide to the rules and regulations according to the ego-centeredness, this, of course, you might experience. You could say, you know, okay, this is fine, so why not do it? So you could say, this is perfectly okay. Why criticize it? The problem is unexpected, sudden events which might violate everything which you've done, which might be destructive, which might change everything, which might actually lead to a catastrophe or lead to something which actually, which is then of course very difficult to deal with. This might be things which on the personal life set, it might be a setting, it might be, for instance, that you suddenly have an impulse to completely change everything you've done because of, for instance, falling in love. I remember dealing with someone and he was going to Japan. And he was one of those functionaries, you know, he had a position in the bank, had a very good high position in the bank. He commuted between Frankfurt, Zurich and London, so he was always first class, of course, understood. And so he had a tremendous life, which I thought was very much in control. And so when he was, then he took this flight to Tokyo. And on the plane, he was tended to by the stewardess, and he kind of talked with her and so, and then after a while they felt some kind of likeness, they were fond of each other, and then so over India or so they felt it's more than just, you know, that they like each other, and maybe over Thailand or so they realized it's emotions, you know, emotions are there, and when they landed in Tokyo, they decided they'll spend 3 days together. And he was completely in another world, passionate, fell in love, and so he thought, this is it, this is passion. You know, my wife, my family is okay, you know, she's a decent person, but there's no emotion, there's no passion in there. This is it, this is where I have to, this is my deed, this is actually where my aim, my goal. So he completely changed. He decided to leave his family. He flew back. And his family expected him at the airport and said, I'm leaving you. I'm leading another life. And so I'm going with this, my new love. And as you can suspect, of course, it was a complete catastrophe. Because in reality, they did not understand each other. They understood each other up in the air, maybe, but not on the ground. On the ground, it was a bit more difficult. It only lived for about 3-4 months, but it was interesting that someone was taken, you know, completely and completely engulfed by these emotions. And so these are things which might then happen. And if you would analyze it, of course, you could say there was another side of himself which he did not identify, which he did not see. So actually, this other love affair, she was a kind of a symbol of something which was inside of him, because it wasn't a real relation, as you know. You only know the value of a relation after you've had certain conflicts and you're still around after a conflict. That's when you really get to know each other. And if you know then, so this, you know, it was kind of a fantasy, but which had a tremendous pool, a tremendous attraction for him, which gave him the sense, this is the way it has to be. So it was an unbelievable unconscious force which took control of him and led to a complete change of life. And this is something which happens often. It also happens not just in the individual setting. It can also happen, of course, in the societal settings. I realize what my impression is that often, you know, new projects which have been done, and we have, for instance, Swissair is a, you know, Swissair, now it's Swiss. If you analyze the way actually that function, they've also had the adaption trap, and then they had this hunter strategy, a strategy to buy up many different companies in Europe, you know, the airplane companies, you know, sort of that's what they had, and they were getting into something more and more crazy. And I remember hearing once that they had to pay each day about 20, each day 10 or to 20 million francs to Sabena in Belgium to keep that company afloat, which is completely crazy. So they were actually, and as you know, suddenly they couldn't pay the petrol anymore. Suddenly there was a moment where there's no money around, no cash around to pay for the kerosene. And that's why we got grounded and Swiss Air actually collapsed. So these are just examples. And you see these examples happen again and again. So someone follows this egocentricness, excludes everything else. There's only one plan, no plan B. That's the best way. We're great. We're leaders, of course. We're the ones who are in control. We're the ones who know. And we're also serving community, we're a part of life, we're important figures, and so, but the danger is that suddenly something else creeps up, another force which might change the whole setting, which you had not perceived before. I gave you the example of the First World War. If you look at the way Clark describes it, afterwards, of course, one is always wiser, but you could see also these signs, you know, that it was a kind of confinement, you know, a kind of adaptation to something, and they didn't really see what the other side it was. And that's something you see in many cases, as I said, in individual lives, in collective life, that this adaptation traps can lead to kind of a difficulty. It can also express itself before in compulsions. Suddenly people have certain compulsions. They might not be, I know someone telling me that he suddenly had the compulsion. He was actually a 17-year-old. He said he wanted to push his father into the lake. It was a bit crazy. He was very reflecting on it. You know, said, I feel this urge to push my father into the lake. I don't know why. I keep thinking of it. I have to push my father. It had a deeper meaning because he was also adapting to a lot of sceneries. This is the way it indicated. Something appears. So it's often compulsions which indicate that there might be another aspect, another complex, another issue which we are not attending to. I think it's therefore important to reflect, who are we? What are human beings? And there I think Jungian psychology has a lot to offer. I think human beings are basically irrational. Irrational, that means we're full of contradictions. Actually, we're full of, and we're ambivalent about many things. So we're not, irrational means that often what we do is not exactly what we think is the goal, so it's an interpretation afterwards. You know, that's interesting when you listen to these books, memoirs of business people who've been successful. Yakoa, I think, is one example. You know, they usually reinterpret their past according to the goals they've reached, and then they think everything has a certain value. So, well, it's all about whatever. But in reality, no, it's just an interpretation. In reality, knows when life is often floating from one incident to the other, and it's not really, you can never really control. But there you see the irrational and the rational. So it's, life is irrational. We're not to control ourselves is a bit of an illusion. So we have forces inside ourselves which are not controllable, but which we can approach. We can approach them, we can somehow attend to them, that's what we can do, but we cannot control them. And I think there Jungian psychology is very important, because Jung tried to develop a language, tried to develop an understanding for this irrational inner worlds, which are also a reality. So Jung was not just writing for this ego-centered world outside, so he was trying to grasp this inner world. Now you have certain difficulties. If you try to grasp the inner world, the otherness, as you would call it, or the unforeseeable, or maybe the strangeness, of course you can't use a very precise language. You can't measure it. We can't measure our dreams. We can't, so it's, as it, because it's the only way actually to approach it is that we also appreciate that we also take into consideration things like our dreams, our emotions, our body reactions, that we take this into consideration, that we also try to imagine, you know, imagination. All these things are very important, but they're not precise. And often they're a lot more approachable, a lot more, we can perceive them through other means, poetry or art, you know, things, other means, images are actually more precise, are more accurate or more fit more this inner world than actually measurement or preciseness. That's why for Jung it was very important to think of images. Think images is a way where this otherness, these other forces might express themselves. And of course images and symbols have many different meanings at the same time. And Jung actually was trying to introduce a psychology which enables us to read ourselves and our surrounding through the symbolic approach, and to see, well, this might be something else, something other expressing itself, which our egoness is not able to grasp. So for Jung, it's important not to know in order to get to know something. So not to have the notion of control, but to have the notion, well, I don't know what will happen. So the notion, maybe we could say curiosity. It's like he said, with every patient, he thinks, I don't know anything. You know, he wrote that somewhere. He said, when a patient comes to me, I have the notion, well, I haven't a clue. That's very important. Then you allow more. So a modern approach, like in cognitive psychology, where you say, well, you have to define, is actually completely the opposite. Then you don't allow this otherness. So this is important. So he also was trying then, of course, to write up certain terms like animus, anima, and you know, polarities are very important with Jung. You have other feminine and the masculine. And so polarities are important also because not to fall prey to this one-sidedness, like I described before, you know, like when you believe in certain core terms like education. So you always have to think in polarities because you might have overlooked something. For Jung, of course, the language, in order to decipher the inner world, you have to take into consideration, which I think is important, the transcendent function. You know, transcendence, I think, is a very important term because it tells you there's always something, there's an otherness which we're unable really, might be unable to detect. So, and this is, there's a transcendence function, maybe this otherness, this other meaning might want to be transcended to us, might have something to tell us, might be something very important. And this otherness, or this unconsciousness, of course, expresses itself to many different ways. As I said, it expresses itself, of course, through dreams, but it expresses itself through what we call Freudian slips, through things which happened. I think that is it. So it's important for Jung to be able to read, to interpret ourselves as the way we are, and not to believe that we are just in control of ourselves, or not to fall prey of just the self-image or the ego-centeredness. I think there actually Jungian psychology has a lot to offer to keep that up. But now, of course, what does it mean? And of course what it means is this otherness, or this other might also contain something which we think is very important for us, or has a really so-called deeper meaning. And there, of course, the idea of the self comes up, so that we might have a center somewhere in us, or out of us, which might have something to tell us, or to transcend an energy, which might give us the feeling of evidence, gives us the feeling of self-assuredness, or gives us the feeling this has a deeper meaning. And these are usually experiences which are not really controllable. So you can't go to the Alps and look at the sunset and say, okay, now look, I want to have this enhancement, have the feeling of, I get an impression which will change my life. It doesn't work that way. So you just have to kind of wait and float, and maybe something appears, maybe it doesn't appear because it has an own dynamic. It might be something completely unexpected. I know someone who's now a very dedicated teacher. He looks for handicapped children, and his core experience he had is when he was a student. He was a student, and it was, I think, 16 or 17, they had to visit a handicapped home in Winterthur. And he remembered he was going there, you know, they were fooling around, they were not interested in all these handicapped children, you know, but he was forced to. And he remembers he was there, and he saw a therapist. He was doing music therapy, dancing music therapy, with deaf and blind children, so they didn't hear and they couldn't see. And he was doing music therapy and was teaching them to dance. And the way he did it, he had a floor, and the floor vibrated, and he kind of made sort of vibrations, so he had a kind of a tool that he could, you know, transmit vibration through the floor, so the children were on the floor, and they were touching the floor with their hands, and waiting, you know, for the vibrations. And he said he had this experience, he looked at it, and then this, you know, very sort of, the children came in, they lay on the floor, and he started with his rhythms, and then suddenly, one girl stood up and danced. She started to dance. And he was a bit, he saw that, and that really touched him, that she started up and started to dance. And that was a key experience which then led him to choose that particular profession. So it was a better, deeper experience than anything else. All the consultation and assessments, you know, he had and what shall I do. It was this kind of experience which suddenly touched him and suddenly revealed something about a sense of life. So with many people, it's experiences like that which come to us and which we can't really control, which we can't control. They come to us independently. So if you see that the sense of life, you know, is not something, or the meaning, the deeper meaning, it's not something you can really sort of organize, but something you maybe just have to wait for. But of course you have to be open for it. Of course you have to, it can be something, often in retrospect, it could be something. So it's not always that you have a direct experience. I think there analysis is very important, you know, reflection is important. It can happen in retrospect. I know for someone who was a politician here in Switzerland, and he says, but this is something which happened in retrospect. He always thinks of himself growing up in a section of Zurich where the industry is very important. So he thinks of himself as a working class hero, kind of. And he has these pictures of the Italian immigrants coming in those days now, and you know, having a difficult life. So as a politician, this was the image he had in order to follow up a political life. This is actually what kept him motivated. So it's interesting, it can be these experiences where our psyche or our soul somehow transmits some kind of message which touches us, but then might have a deeper meaning, gives us what I would call a sense of purpose. A sense of purpose, a self of dedication. And what is important, though, is that we distance ourselves maybe from that, the societal calls or rule, that we kind of have a kind of aloofness. So I think the approach, because as I said before, if you're too much identified with society, if you're too much in that kind of hubbub of everyday life, you know, so you suddenly don't see that, you don't have any time, you don't have any waiting time, you don't have any openness, because everything is actually controlled. So that's, I think, is very important, that you're able to distance yourself, that you're able to be aloof and you're able to keep some kind of one room inside yourself empty for the unexpected. Something could happen there. That, I think, is very important. And this, I think, because the self, maybe our soul or something else, might transmit something which might be important, but often it's something which is not in mainstream. Often it's something which is does not connect yourself, is not connected to what you're actually doing. It could also be that you do a mistake, you know, that you might forget something or so, and then I know someone who forgot a very important meeting, and then afterwards he realized there was a reason, you know, why he forgot it. It wasn't just, you know, of course you don't have to always just think of everything you forget, it has a deeper meaning, but it had a kind of evidence. So I think it's important. But then afterwards, when you have this sense, you need some kind of aggression. You need kind of aggression to keep up that position. Because often it means that you have to sacrifice something. And what you have to sacrifice, of course, is maybe the narcissistic confirmation you get when you're part of society. The narcissistic confirmation when you get the greatness you might receive from being someone important. That's what you might have to relinquish. I know a Swiss writer here, and I think he's a good writer, but I think he's getting a bit, you know, on the popular side. But he himself got a bit annoyed because he got so many prizes. You know, he got sort of prizes, and he realizes getting prizes means I'm adapting too much. There's something wrong with me, you know. I can't get all these prizes by this committee and committees. This is something. So it means actually, and there you have the dilemma, it means in some ways to contradict, to do and go another path, actually, than the path of the adaptation trap or the societal role. So this is actually the challenge you have to meet. You have this kind of experiences which might often not be in connection to what you're doing, which might often tell you something else, which might often lead some another way, which might often mean that you have to somehow make some kind of steps in order to pursue that what you think has a deeper meaning, but this of course means that you have to alienate yourself from something else, which then would mean that you're actually antisocial. So there I think it's you're confronted with a dilemma. And there again I think something is important. What is important that we see that psyche or the psychological life, psychology, the psyche of every person has a lot more possibilities and is a lot wider than what any society can actually take up. There again, I think it's important. This is something which James Hillman, of course, always emphasized. It's important that we also start to think of mythologies. That mythologies, by mythologies, I mean all these great stories which kind of try to contain what we experience, these mythologies are very important. You know, it could be the Greek mythologies, So it's actually mythologies often have features or describe archetypes which describe other possibilities in life. And so actually psychology can be done in reflect of your psyche. I think archetypal images could be used. This is what I often try to do in schools, where I try to sort of reflect with students, no children, not with the usual terms ADHD, bipolar, psychosis, autism, but I say, well, maybe you're a bit of a hero, you know. You're a hero. You're following the hero path, as Joseph Campbell described. And I see that if you, of course, hero means that you may be obnoxious at school, that you may be, you know, and irritating, but you're following another path. And I see that this enhances them, gives them a wider perspective. At the same time, of course, as a hero, you can't always annoy anyone else. So I think there we need another language which is not, which is important. So it could be archetypal. Also, what is important is that religion is included. And that's it's often tricky because religion is about believing. Religion is believing in God or so. So this means is of course something very which were personal. But you have to also see what the repercussions are of when you believe in something. When you believe in something, there's repercussions. So there's always a belief, core belief, but then there's a result, what it results into. And these repercussions, you know, that, you know, when you believe, you can be determined to do something. You have a complete, you're absolutely sure of it because of a experience of otherness. An experience of otherness gives you the energy to do something. And there I often think that religion is not, or the believing is not included enough in our reflection of everyday life. Because this core, you know, this sense, something gives me a belief in something as a determination, is actually something which we have to reflect on. I see, you know, the problem that we have in Europe, that certain people follow ISIS, young people, you know, they want to become terrorists, and they're usually very adapted young people, you know, so that they're not actually obnoxious, strange people, you know, so they're very adapted, you know, they go to school, they're successful, and suddenly they follow ISIS because they project some kind of reincarnation, you know. They search actually for soul often, you know, in that scenario, which is an indication that we somehow don't approach that enough. Because they go through school, their formation, they're taught in a rational, superficial way, and no one tells them actually, listen, you have a soul, and you might have something else which might torment you. And so no one, this is excluded. Sometimes it's often excluded in psychotherapy. So these are things we have to think of. We have to develop a language. We also have to take into consideration the religious experience we have, which actually, when we start thinking of our roles in society. It can also be, and this is interesting, as I mentioned a bit before, that success is also a problem. As I said with the writer, you know, if you're successful, of course you start believing that the way you adapt is the best way. So if you are successful, it can also kind of be have an inner voidness inside themselves, emptiness. I remember one, as a man came to me, and he came on a spontaneous visit because he was in Zurich, but he actually came from Munich. He came to me, said he wanted to have a consultation with me, and he came in and said, "Okay." So he said, "Well, what's your problem?" And he said, "Well, I feel so isolated. I have this tremendous feeling of isolation in my life. I'm not really connected. I feel I don't have any power of anything. I feel like I'm floating in this world." So I, you know, wrote up my notes on power of isolation. And then I asked him, what do you do? And they said, "Well, I'm working for this company, I'm a junior director." He had 10,000 employees under himself. He was one of the most important executives of Europe, you know. And he had this feeling of inner voidness, of senselessness, and he was confronted with that. And that's an interesting phenomenon, you know. You see that you somehow, you're successful, but, you know, for a lot of these people, also, in Switzerland, someone killed himself, or there was the most successful businessman in he had a mobile company, Swisscom, and he was considered, you know, the manager type. You know, he was the type who would live in Lausanne, get up 4 in the morning, climb a mountain, present himself there, you know, very sportive, go into the office at 8, have meetings until 12, fly to somewhere. You know, he had a family and everything. And then he had a kind of failure and just killed himself, you know, which was absurd. I mean, so one realized that there was a lot of debates out there because he was considered the prime example of a successful manager. He was fairly young still, 45, you know, so in good health, everything. So something happened in his life. Apparently it was a bit with his family or so, but nothing, I mean, nothing really that serious, but he completely collapsed, completely, and made this lone decision somehow. So you see, success can also lead to, often it's better to have some healthy failures, you know, because that grounds you again. But if you're successful, you encapsulate it into an own world, and then suddenly it gets even more difficult to get beyond, to free yourself from the adaption trap. So now I come to the last part, and I think I want to say certain words about, you know, the conclusions. So I think deeper meaning has a significance. I think in life as human beings, as we also have a rational side, we also have to contemplate on the deeper sense of purpose, which is presented to us not in a controlled way, but which somehow presents us as someone. We have to be open for this. And society should be read in a symbolic way. So everything should be read not just in a functional way. So this is important as an attitude we have towards life. I think that's important. And as I said, it's important to be open towards the unexpectedness. But now, of course, what does it mean to in order to be include yourself in communal services? Because that's what we're talking about. How can this be combined with communal services? How can we be part of society and at the same time, of course, be connected to ourselves or connected to the sense of being? How this is actually a contradiction, you know. We could say it's a lot easier. And I think one problem with, I think, is sad to say, often also with Jungians, is that when they perceive this sense of meaning, they start to detach themselves from society. I remember talking to someone who just finished the Jung Institute, and she was an important people in Asia, and she studied here for 4 years, and before she was a businesswoman. And then I met her in Asia, and I talked to her and said, "Well, what do you do now?" And I had the image she would go back and do something, you know, start up with this. "No, I don't want to enter this political world. I don't want to re-enter this business world. I want to keep my inner peace. That's more important." Now, I remember being a bit annoyed. I said, "Well, what's the purpose of this whole formation? What's the purpose of you studying psychology and now you go back and discover your inner world, inner peace?" And I think that's a problem. That's a kind of something which can be kind of led on to the wrong way. Being connected to yourself does not mean you don't have to be able to sacrifice yourself. Does not mean to be able not to do something for community. But what's important is that you read it the right way. I think the best way actually to enter a role in society, the best way is that you keep, first of all, a kind of playfulness. Playfulness, you know, playing, the word playing, Spiel, from Germany, comes here from dancing. You know, that you don't just follow one pattern, but you might have the alternative pattern. You know, you have the extra step, and not just the step which leads you to the particular goal. So playfulness is a very important, that you somehow play with everything you do. Playing means that you allow yourself other thoughts. You allow yourself remarks which are out of place. You allow yourself fantasies which are perhaps not quite appropriate. You allow yourself contrarian thinking. I think that is important, that you keep up a sense of playfulness, which not just a sense of functioning, because when you have a sense of functioning, being efficient, you abide to the ego and then you might exclude the other side. I think that's one part which is very important. Of course, you have to also keep this sense of otherness, you know, sense that is always expected. I think one has to have to make a restart, like with certain computers, from time to time you have to make a restart. And the restart you should also do with what you do is a kind of say, "Well, I don't know anything, let's be open." Not believe that you give too many answers. That, I think, is a problem with a lot of lecturers at my university. They keep on giving their answers, and so they think they know the answers. And if they have to test their answers, you know, they know their answers, and suddenly they start to self-persuade themselves in what they do. I think that's important. Then, of course, what is also important, the sense of appreciating your failures. Failures might also contain something. We all fail of major catastrophes, but we have often a lot of small catastrophes. We might avoid something. So we have to have a sense of failures that where we might do something might not develop or happen the way we are, because it might also tell us something. Also, what we have to respect is keep connected with people and things which irritate us. So it's important to have, I think, for instance, if you have friends which irritate you, that's very important. And by irritation, I don't just mean friends which have very sound, good arguments, which really irritate you, which annoy you, which you think, now this is something very strange. I think this is important. Also, be connected maybe to people which don't belong to your realm, your part of society. I have the privilege, of course, that I can work with young people. So I'm connected twice a week with very young people, with 7-8-year-olds and 15-16-year-olds. And so this morning I had a 10-minute discussion with someone, with the cleaner. When I go over the Stadelhofen in Zurich, there's always the same cleaner, you know, brushing the... And I talked with him a little bit, and he talked about how important it is to see the mountains in the morning. He couldn't talk very well because he's a bit handicapped. So he was there cleaning, and in the morning he said, "Oh, guten Morgen, guten Morgen." I said, "Oh, good morning." And as I was trying to be unpunctual, I thought, well, I engaged in a kind of, this is more important, this discussion. I was still punctual, yes, but you know, so I was there, and then he said, "Yeah, I'm getting retirement in 2 years, and I have a place where I can see each morning the mountains. That's important." You know, so keeping open for things like that, your small gossips, and this is important, not just to follow your pattern, I think, so, but also, as I said, people, and this gives you a sense of belong, because I think we're all embedded into something, so our society, our surrounding is also important. We belong to a certain culture, and we're, this culture might tell us something, so we might also have a deed. I've been talking to you, for instance, about California, and she's been telling me I have kind of a Swiss, I don't know what, preciseness or what, a Swiss way of thinking, and this is something I perceive too, that when I'm here in Switzerland, I have another way of thinking, and I think I'm influenced by the surrounding, I'm influenced by the smallness of our country, I'm influenced by the different cultures, because we in Switzerland know that we don't understand each other, because with the French speaking, the Italian speaking, they're completely different. So we always have differences. So we always have to study who is he. And so and I remember once having a project in California, and I enjoyed California with this greatness and terrific and fantastic, but everything got a bit flaky. Yeah, suddenly, you know, so. Which was also good, you know, but I realized I myself started to think that particular way. So one is embedded, one has a certain role, and this is important. So we have to also be modest. Actually, we are all political beings. Actually, we're all part of the society. And therefore, I think it's important that we also do our deeds. And if you think of individuation, to individuate means that we also take into consideration all these other forces, don't just adapt, but maybe reinterpret it, what happens outside, maybe reflect on it, what happens outside, but maybe also seek some significance in outside, not just return, sort of retreat to the personal. That I think is important, because we are political, but it needs a kind of modesty. And what is most important, I think, and this is the general attitude, I said life is has a lot of ambivalences, contradictions. We're always confronted with contradictions. People strive for the good, but they overdo the bad. We want something happen, but then chaos happens. So it's full of contradictions. And if you work in a societal role, you're constantly confronted with contradictions. Constantly. I mean, you want to do, for instance, you build a building, where I work in Zurich, a gigantic building which has a lot of rooms where people can meet, but it's completely false, defined in a way that people can't meet. Because, you know, it's sort of, the one meeting room is on the 12th floor, and actually the courts is on the ground floor. So it's they blundered completely. So you're always confronted with absurdities in life. And now, of course, there's a choice you can make. You can say, okay, I deal with my small little world. I go to the Alps and stare at the mountains. And then there's less absurdities, except the bad weather, of course. That's a bit annoying. But, you know, then you have less absurdities. Or you could say, I accept it. I try to decipher that every day, other than strange things that happen. And what it needs, and I think this is very important, is a love of life. You need a love of life. Does one love life? Does one actually be able to dedicate yourself to life? That's actually what it needs in order to dedicate yourself to communal services. So if you able to dedicate yourself, you realize to communal service that you might, your career might end in a scandal. That's something which is just the way, if you're a public figure, the chances are very high that your career ends in a scandal. That's just the way it is. Since we have to accept. You know, it's not about true or false. Life, as I said, is full of uncertainty, but that's what it means. But when you have a love of life, you said, okay, I'll give it a try, and I have maybe a certain role there, even though it means I might have to sacrifice myself, even though it means my public role might be redefined once, but that, of course, is then sort of on the other side, is that maybe you have a sense of meaning, a sense of purpose for what you do. So that's what I wanted to say. So I'm finished. Yeah.
Are you open to questions and comments?
Yeah, yeah, of course. Yeah.
How can I say it? So I'm kind of interested in, I was in a spiritual community that I have left, it was kind of in this whole collective self, really, and it was not in integrity with my own integrity, with my own individuation, and so interested in the psychology of it, the projections onto the leader, and then how they can lie, manipulate, and abuse people, and everything. And somehow the whole group, like they don't see it. They have this necessary projection, and then I'm sure this happens in all kinds of organizations. And then what happens, and the loss I've experienced, and taking a stand, which what is just.
Yep.
Was not right, you know, for me, and how to leave that, and so many issues about, you know, what's black, what's white, and that's what I'm doing here, like some kind of integration. But I think, you know, I'm trying to, and it's not that it's gray, you know, it's like how to be with the black and the white, and I'm just hearing this in your presentation also, like how do I follow my path? Also with that kind of tolerance for the other, and yet there are some things that one must take a stand, you know, that really feels wrong in the world, you know.
Yeah.
So I'm just throwing this out because I'm just taking anything in to help me to create more of that kind of tolerance in myself, and yet be clear, you know, not be in the ambiguous of, you know, getting pulled into what you were saying in the beginning of how we adapt, you know, like that. And so it's such a, it's not really that clear, is it?
No. And I think you're pointing out something very important. It's not clear. And of course, we often strive for clarity in life. As I said, clarity and control and decisions. And so that's what we strive for. And then these other things might become very attractive. Following a leader who's got the message and he knows it. And as we know, from many cases, usually there's a tremendous amount of abuse. I have a sister of a very good friend of mine. She followed a leader into India. And he, you know, you have to dedicate all your wealth, all the monies to him. And now she visited him in Stockholm, because he has a place in Stockholm too. And he has a Rolls Royce. A Rolls Royce. And then he explained to his followers, I need the Rolls Royce in order to impress the people outside. So this kind of foolish excuse, which is absurd. So, but then you see, you sometimes completely enhanced. It's what a delusion and this kind of. It's a problem. And I think what is important that we don't fall for this control, you know, in the whole education, maybe in the way we actually been brought up. We have to keep up this idea of otherness. And I think maybe if one could generalize, it's a bit of a fallacy in our society, because we're so successful in technology, you know, and this success in technology, which started in the 12th, 14th century, you know, we went on and on and on, and so this actually gave us the delusion that we're in control also of the spiritual and the mind. I think that's where, in the technological world, we really did great things, but in other aspects, realms of life, I'm not so sure. So we actually should keep a sense of our kind of way we think of the anima world, you could say. We could keep a sense of that. At the same time, of course, take care of the technological advancements and appreciate that too. But we kind of mix that up. You know, we think we're also a great success in the spiritual.
Like a false power.
Yes, it's like a false power. It's like a friend of mine said. I was quite impressed by his remark. He worked in Africa, in the Sudan then, and he went there, and then a friend of his was visiting him, and her father had just died a week before. And they went into a bus, and she came and talked to him and so, and talked about the death. And then when they were sitting in a bus, and sort of suddenly an African woman came up, a black woman came up to her and said, "What's the matter with you? I see something in your eyes, you know. So, you know, it's okay." He said, you know, just said that. And she was completely astonished. But she was open to this, what she experienced at that particular moment. And often we look at Africa as a failed continent. Africans, they completely failed. Of course they failed in economical terms, perspective, you know, technology, they're completely failing. You know, Germany gave him 60 buses to Tanzania, you know, in the Dar es Salaam, I think it's called, the main town. And a year later, out of the 60 buses, only 10 functioned, so they could not take care of technology. Now, this might lead to a kind of, you know, highbrowness, as a conceitedness. But in other aspects, realms, I think they might be underdeveloped. You know, there I think we have a lot of things to do.
I think this word clarity, you know, and thinking about clarity, also embraces this idea that you're talking about, that we don't know.
Yeah.
And you can just kind of accept that, too. We don't know. And we think we're always, when everybody says to you, you know, "Well, why'd you do that?" We always come up with something.
Yeah.
But we don't know.
No.
And you know, you stop and think about it for a while, you don't. But you have needs, and, you know, you understand. So this clarity is sort of an acceptance of the reality of all that we don't know.
Yeah.
And that the door's open. And yeah, maybe we want to go through that door, but we don't really know why.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. This kind of giving answers, it's so strange,
yeah.
Oh, giving and evidence-proofed answers, you know, that's the way it is.
Yeah.
I started to walk out of any lectures where the lecturer points out twice, mentions twice the word evidence-based. So I decided to walk out, because I think, well, he has a closed mind. Well, this is evidence-based, and so, you know. Unfortunately, for instance, the American Psychological Association put that evidence-based. We only publish evidence-based, which I think is really sad, you know, actually. You want to say something?
The word sacrifice is in the title of your talk, and I wonder if you would just comment on...
Yeah. Yeah, thank you. I have it here too, but for some reason, no. It means actually, the subjective feeling. You sacrifice something. First of all, you sacrifice, of course, a sense of narcissistic ego and enhancement, and you know that's what you sacrifice. Because when we are a part of society and follow the adaptation trap, we somehow get this kind of value for ourselves, you know. And if you actually dedicate yourself to community life, you realize that maybe you personally might not get a lot of it, out of it, because you personally might, at the end, you might fail. You might introduce something, if you're a politician, a new law, and then after the end, someone else takes all the goodies or all the success for himself. Or if you're in family is, of course, also a way of community life. If you have to look after for the children and so, and then afterwards they leave, and you might be glad when you get an occasional phone call. But, you know, but the sacrifice, of course, for instance, for families is enormous, unbelievable, you know. I have 3 children, but I realized I could have a Rolls Royce, you know. I'm so sorry. I could have a... Yes. You know, it's somehow... you have a lot of things when it's but of course a lot of people sacrifice a lot personally because this is more important for them. But it's actually, if you would only look at it from an ego perspective, it's a bit absurd. Why should you have a, why should you sacrifice? So you have this enormous sacrifice you make for a family, keeping up the family, and it goes on, of course, you know. So that's what I mean by sacrifice. I think if you work in a community role, you have to sacrifice a lot of things. Also, it means, of course, for instance, life can be a bit more stressful. You know, you have to, for instance, banalities. You have to get up early in the morning, for instance. Although your inner peace, you know, it would be better for your inner peace to get up, you know, whenever you wake up and follow the dream. So you have things like that to do. You have to really, it's, and that's also sacrifice. Or if you work in a community, or, you know, when I work now here in Bern with the directing department of group psychotherapy, we have projects there, but this also means, of course, that I have to talk to people, I have to talk to politicians, and then decisions are made, which I think are absurd, and then I have to come persuade. So this means, you know, I'd rather go out and have a, maybe a walk, you know, and so do something else. But that's what I mean by sacrifice. You have to also be able to sacrifice, but you have to be kind of tuned into another realm, another level, you know, that I think. Sometimes you see with politicians, I think the politician of, the president of Uruguay, he was I forgot his name, he was a good example. He's now not president anymore, but he was there in Uruguay for the last 5 years. He always had the same car, a Beetle, you know, five Beetles, Volkswagen. And while he was president, he didn't change his car. But what was interesting, at the end of his presidency, a lot of people made offerings. They wanted to buy his car because he kept it living in the same space. And he refused to sell it. It's my car, you know. So I think that is, he's, apparently from what I know from him, he kept a kind of centeredness. You know, he didn't get into this narcissistic trap, which usually happens to a lot of people as soon as they get into this other role.
When that turning point comes, where you realize this is what you need to do, that one of the sacrifices is you can't make everybody happy anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, that's,
and you have to displease or disappoint or hurt your children,
yeah,
or, you know, whatever it might be. And that seems to be such a sticking point sometimes for people to make that shift.
I think that's an important point you made. Yes, I think that you want to please everyone. That might also be an adaption. That's
mm-hmm.
true. That you want to have everyone make it. You know. Yeah, that, I think it's a very good point.
So I mean, that
yeah.
is a narcissistic.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Sense of success too.
Yeah.
You can please everyone, but it's also difficult to know that your other people
yeah, yeah.
will be hurt by what you said.
Yeah. And there you actually then have to evaluate, you know, what is more important, what's the counter argument, counterweight, and that's, you have to get a sense of what is important to me really to do. But you actually, I think there you would trapped into sort of the harmony, you know, you want to be live in a most, in a completely harmonious surrounding and not offend anybody. But as soon as you actually pursue something, so you always offend people. And you have to leave people, and you have to distance yourself, and that might be also a trap. That happens often to women when they would pursue a career. You know, they would pursue a career, and then they don't want to pursue it because they think they might offend a colleague, or then the boss of that colleague, and then they don't want to be the boss of that colleague. So they relinquish the career, which I think is a bit. It might be important that they, you know, the. Give their talents or, you know, their leadership qualities for the career, you know, to sacrifice. But then they don't do it because they think, I don't want to be. That, I think, for instance, is one of the reasons why there are a lot less women who are CEOs in our country. One of the reasons is they don't want to be, they don't want to risk being considered... you know, to distance, what's the word, you know, They fail to distance themselves from other people or get the criticism they don't like. Men seem to have a tradition in that, or they may be more ego-centered, I don't know, whatever. But men don't have difficulties with that, but women have. And that, I think, is one of the major reasons.
Well, I think men are raised to feel entitled, that's my future.
Yeah, exactly.
And women are more, mm-hmm. I think,
to please.
To think, I can have that if I can take care of all these other people.
What if I can please the people in consent? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I don't know if that's different. I don't want to give you too big.
Not all environments. I think, for instance, schools, education is set up by women mm-hmm. now currently. So your most children grow up in a feminine surrounding until they're 18, 19, 20, even in universities now. So, but in business world, I think that's the case. The business world here. Yes, of course.
We were talking at our table this morning about Pope Francis, who is certainly the leader of the Catholic Church, and who appears to be breaking rank with many different previously held positions.
Yes.
And how, and on the one hand, how astonishing it is that he's doing this, and on the other, how courageous it is.
Courageous. Yes,
courageous.
Yes.
Yeah.
I don't know him personally, of course. I don't know him at all. But, I mean, I wouldn't now feel entitled to make a remark. But what I think is astonishing with him, that he keeps this connection, you know, and also that he uses public transport.
Right.
Yes, and he somehow talks to all the people. And that's my impression I get of him. You know, he's kind of not following the whole Vatican system, which is a very closed world, and captain, the one is usually encapsulated. That's my impression.
Mm-hmm. He tries to go forward focused.
I think. I'm impressed by that, what I hear, how he enters the whole Vatican and irritates people there.
Yeah.
Inside the Vatican, it irritates a lot. They're annoyed by him. Yes, that's what you're actually doing.
Since he's at the top,
he's
able to do it a little more easier. Than
exactly,
Yeah.
Yes, but he's trying. He's trying. He's actually
waiting for the other shoe to drop.
Okay. Well, you have another last remark.
I was just thinking, it's almost like the paradigm is shifting around. It's either one or the other, which is kind of worth male and female, masculine and feminine, but it's like the adaptive is somehow that we give in to ourselves, we sacrifice ourselves, and the opposite is the ego, megalomania that we have in society is that we have the power over. But when we're talking about our relationship to the other, it's like if we just coexist, I am this and this is what I am and you are that, mm-hmm. and the experience of it just being without mm-hmm. me having to convince you or have power over you mm-hmm. or I have to give in to you because actually I'm less than you.
Yeah.
That feels like just I'm sitting with this, a new paradigm of how mm-hmm. all the systems can then adapt in that way. That mm-hmm. seems crucial with the environment and our political
system. That's true.
Mm-hmm. That just came to me about your mm-hmm. title.
That's true.
And the love that you mentioned ties in with that. If you can have a love of yourself and know what your gifts are, mm-hmm. you can contribute without controlling.
Yeah, that's true.
And loving the other person recognizes that they have gifts. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And they aren't controlling you. They're offering what they have in this community of society that you live in.
And the love of life means accepting, to a certain extent, also the contradictions. Like that, because it's full of contradictions, everything. It's chaotic. And to accept it, that I think is important. That's the way it is, yes. So let's do something with it, or let's have some fun, or whatever.
Yeah, and that's the other thing I was going to say, is that work as play. I can remember in the 70s going to Colorado, to Estes Park, and Ram Dass, there, and he was promoting this work as play. Oh. And you brought that up about playfulness and just a sense of humor and some kind of, you know, you can't take it all too seriously.
No, not exactly.
And keeping that way of seeing things and being is important.
Yes, and for some reason this serious attitude is overvalued. Yeah. You know, serious or so, but it's, you know, it's human beings function often in a better way, have more ideas, are a lot more imaginative when they're playful, and not when they're serious. The best ideas usually come when you play, and not when you're studious, you know, concentrating on something.
We're not that serious in California.
Yeah, so many things develop in California, you know, many great ideas.
Yeah.
California is the place which, in contrary to Europe, where new industries developed out of this playfulness. And in Europe, you know, there's no new industries, which is really astonishing.
California has a reputation, though, you know, around the states, I think, sometimes, that California is a little
out there.
Yeah, right. But anyway, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Oh, I get some money. Yeah, great.
Just being playful.
Oh, you want this? Okay.
Thank you so
much.
Yes, of course.
That'd be great.
Come on, get it.